It's no secret that our planet is facing some dire challenges. From climate change and biodiversity loss to soil degradation and water pollution, the Earth is in pain. And it's also no secret that our societies around the world are also in a scary place. Severe social isolation, mental illness, and political division plague our communities. Oppressive systems like poverty and patriarchy seem to fuel these challenges and threaten our health, our relationships with each other, and our connection to the Earth. In the face of all this, I found myself asking, what can be done? What is being done? That's where this podcast and the research that anchors it comes in. My name is Akil Cole, and you're listening to Peace of Earth. This podcast mini-series is part of my senior thesis at Georgetown University, where I'm majoring in interdisciplinary studies with a focus on peace and sustainability. As I mentioned, I want to know what can be done and what is being done to alleviate our world's most pressing environmental and social problems. But what can be done about the state of the world is way too broad and complex for one college student to address in his thesis. So, with the help of my professors, I narrowed down my research question to the following. How do environmental justice and food organizations use farming and land-based initiatives to pursue community transformation away from oppressive systems and toward community resistance to those systems? I know that was a mouthful, but just hang with me. You might be asking,
why focus on those types of organizations and that type of work?
I found myself especially curious about community-level approaches to these environmental and social problems. This curiosity has been strongly informed by my experience interning with, and later serving on the board of directors for, the Community Ecology Institute, or CEI, a nonprofit organization based in Columbia, Maryland, that seeks to, quote, cultivate communities where people and nature thrive together. As an intern at CEI's Freetown Farm, a regenerative 6.4-acre farm with several types of gardens, I grew curious about the ways community gardening, urban agriculture, nature-based education, and other land-based initiatives were being used to bring people together in a local community and address various environmental, health, and social challenges. With lessons from that experience in mind, my passion was piqued about something else. What do community-level approaches to social and environmental problems look like in other countries? Well, to start scratching the surface on that question, I took the opportunity to study abroad in Cape Town, South Africa, at two points during the summer of 2023. There, I learned of several organizations engaged in community gardening and home gardening work. One of those organizations was Soil for Life, a, quote, public benefit organization that teaches people how to grow their own food, improve their health and well-being, and nurture and protect the environment. I was like, oh man, this right here is what I've been searching for. So in between conversations with community leaders and class visits to townships and community centers, I grew interested in the home food garden training program at Soil for Life, among other things. Though the main focus of my study abroad programs was not gardening or farming, I had a feeling that I'd be returning to the subject in preparation for this here thesis.
All right, so how did you approach research for this thesis?
Well, this is a comparative case study involving two municipalities, Columbia, Maryland in the United States, and Cape Town, located in Western Province, South Africa. Within these two municipalities, I'll be highlighting the work of two organizations, one in Columbia and one in Cape Town. I used qualitative methods for this comparative case study by conducting semi-structured interviews with key informants from the Community Ecology Institute. I used stakeholder mapping for each organization to identify key informants using purposeful sampling. The purpose of conducting interviews was to collect information from a wide range of people who have firsthand knowledge about the particular organization. For Soil for Life, on the other hand, the organization in Cape Town that my study highlights, my qualitative data comes from several different types of sources. A book that compiled the firsthand accounts of 10 women home gardeners that were trained by Soil for Life, an article wherein the organization's founder was interviewed, and the organization's website. For a more detailed look at my methods, check the links in the episode notes or just listen to episode 4 of this mini-series. I also use secondary sources, from academic articles to news, to research the relevant historical context and socioeconomic factors of the two cities where their organizations are based. Like plants, these organizations do not exist in vacuums, but in complex ecosystems of individuals, other organizations, and governments. These different actors in Colombia and Cape Town, along with the city's respective histories and cultures, form the soil from which the studied environmental justice and food-growing organizations grow. As you'll learn throughout this mini-series, at least I hope you do, certain factors lead to conditions that are more likely to create fertile ground for community transformation, while other conditions reinforce oppressive systems. Speaking of communities, who does your research involve?
Well, that's people doing the work, including community leaders, staff members, and members of boards of directors. There's also people served by the work, including volunteers, interns, students, and everyday people in the communities where these organizations exist. And finally, my research includes people who may not know about the work. That means you, the listener.
What background information is essential for us to know as audience members so that we understand future episodes?
I'm glad you asked. You see, Columbia, Maryland is a planned community that was built with the intention of racial, economic, and religious integration. In a lot of ways, Columbia has been largely successful in this integration, though there's a lot of progress still to be made. In contrast, Cape Town, Western Province, South Africa, was established with segregation at its roots, from its colonial history and apartheid history. Even 3 decades after the end of apartheid, Cape Town remains South Africa's most segregated city. Also, I'm basing the concept of systems of oppression on this idea called the triangle of violence. In the triangle of violence, at the top is direct violence, at the bottom on one side is structural violence, and on the bottom on the other side is cultural violence. Direct violence is what you might expect and includes things like physical assault, burning things, gun violence, burglary, and so on. Structural violence involves systems that act to keep people down. Key examples of structural violence include poverty, racial segregation or apartheid, and economic inequality. And cultural violence, on the other hand, was something that was very new to me coming into college and is essentially the justification and normalization of the other two kinds of violence. For example, listen to this conversation between Mr. Left and Mr. Right.
Poverty is a systemic issue that has a lot more to do with an unequal society that fails to properly provide opportunity, resources, and support across its populations, and thus poverty is a structural form of violence.
I disagree. Poverty and the people that experience it have a lot more to do with personal choice and morality, and folks that are stuck in a so-called poverty trap are actually experiencing a moral failing.
That second point of view is a form of cultural violence because it justifies the existence of structural violence, in this case, in the form of poverty. And with this justification, it helps to continue the existence of that structural violence. You see, this triangle of violence is conceptualized as a triangle because at the top, we have what is obvious and direct, right? Direct violence. But if you can imagine, there's a line going through the middle of the triangle, you'll see below this line is structural and cultural violence, things that are less obvious to the eye and much harder to pinpoint as so-called violent. But what connects all three forms of violence is the idea that any force outside of an individual's choices that limits their ability to live a happy, healthy, and fulfilled life is a form of violence. So, when I discuss peace and peaceful communities, I'm not necessarily talking about communities where each of these things is absent. That kind of peace is known as negative peace. Negative because it deals with the absence of a thing. When I discuss peace and peaceful communities, I'm more so looking at positive peace, which deals with the presence of systems that support human health, happiness, and flourishing. These core ideas about the triangle of violence, negative peace, and positive peace come from a scholar named Johann Galtung, who himself was building on a long line of peace thinkers and whose ideas, though new to the Western world, have been articulated in indigenous wisdom across the world for time immemorial. Please check out my show notes for more about Johann Galtung, positive peace, and indigenous articulations of similar ideas.
This mini-series is organized into 4 episodes, including this one. Episode 2, dive into the work of the Community Ecology Institute based in Columbia, Maryland. Episode 3, we'll dive into the work of Soil for Life, based in and around Cape Town, South Africa.
Finally, episode 4 will synthesize and compare the challenges, approaches, and stories of the organizations I present in earlier episodes. Here, I plan to draw key lessons for further research and community action. So, until next time, go outside, talk to someone new, and remember that the peace of Earth begins with you. See ya.